The Eight Immortals Travel East, Chapter 50.
I want you to imagine, just for a second, that you have pulled off the ultimate heist.
Okay, well, listen to me.
You've perfectly executed this massive, sprawling, like mathematically impossible plan. You've breached the unbreachable fortress.
Right.
You've bypassed all the heavily armed security. You've walked right into the vault, and you actually hold in your hands the priceless, stolen treasure that was, you know, rightfully yours to begin with.
The dream scenario.
Exactly. So the adrenaline is pumping, the victory is sweet, the bad guys are thoroughly, undeniably defeated. And then, right there in the middle of the vault, surrounded by like scattered loot and the smoking wreckage of the enemy's defenses, you decide to just roll out a sleeping bag, put on a sleep mask, and take a nap right at the scene of the crime.
I mean, put in those terms, it sounds completely absurd. It borders on like a comedic level of arrogance,
right?
Or perhaps it's just sheer physical exhaustion kind of blinding your common sense. But strangely enough, it is a profoundly human impulse. We have this deep-seated desire to rest exactly on the spot where we won. We want to bask in the geography of our victory.
Yeah, and that bizarre, almost comical scenario isn't just some random hypothetical I came up with. It's the precise setup for the incredible historical source material we're taking in today.
It really is.
We're exploring Chapter 50 of the classic Chinese mythological novel Journey to the East, or Dong Yuji.
And it is just a remarkable layered piece of literature. For those of you who might be, you know, familiar with the broader strokes of Chinese mythology, this chapter focuses on the legendary Eight Immortals.
Yeah, these guys are heavy hitters.
Exactly. And it covers their massive earth-shaking conflict with the Dragon Kings of the Sea. But before we get into the actual clash itself, it's kind of vital to understand the rules of this universe.
Because it's not just like unlimited Harry Potter magic.
Right. Yeah. No, not at all. Magic in this world isn't just a cheat code to do whatever you want. It's deeply tied to the elements, to physical positioning, and to cosmic hierarchies.
Okay, that makes sense.
So the Dragon Kings rule the water passively. It is their domain. The Immortals, on the other hand, are powerful, enlightened beings, but their power often requires active elemental projection.
They have to exert energy to make things happen.
Exactly. They have to work for it.
Well, I want to be really clear with you right off the bat. Our mission for this deep dive isn't just to recap a fantastical story about magical beings throwing fireballs under the ocean.
Though there's plenty of that.
Oh, there's a ton of that. And the imagery is just incredible. But if you look closely at the text, beneath all the, you know, the elemental magic and the mythical creatures, there's this sharp, timeless masterclass hiding in plain sight.
Absolutely.
We're going to extract some major insights on the psychology of victory, the hidden dangers of complacency, and the ultimate art of crisis management.
Because the real value of these ancient texts lies in that exact duality.
The magic is just the vehicle, right? The human behavior is the actual payload.
Yeah.
The catastrophic mistakes these immortal beings make are the exact same psychological blind spots a modern CEO, a military general, or honestly, any of us might suffer from after a major hard-fought personal victory.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the setup for this scene requires some serious context.
Please do.
So the Eight Immortals are essentially the mythological equivalent of a superhero team. They're a ragtag group of enlightened figures, each with highly distinct personalities and powers. And they have just unleashed absolute devastation on the Eastern Sea.
Total devastation.
To get their stolen property back, they literally use their combined magic to boil the ocean. I mean, think about the sheer terrifying scale of that power.
Hard to even picture.
Right. The water evaporates, the sea life is decimated, and the ocean floor is exposed. So they march down into the dry basin, conquer the Dragon Palace, and rout the enemy entirely. And we have to look at why they went to such extreme lengths, you know? The catalyst for this entire apocalyptic conflict is an artifact called the Jade Board.
Right, the Jade Board.
In this mythology, the Jade Board isn't just like a nice piece of jewelry, it's a symbol of cosmic authority. It's a divine ledger of immense prestige.
Mm.
And the Dragon Kings stole it out of sheer pride and greed.
Just to have it.
Exactly. So for the Immortals, recovering this board isn't just some retrieval mission. It is the ultimate vindication. It essentially proves their moral superiority.
So as they walk through this conquered, dried-out underwater palace, they're marveling at the unimaginable wealth. Like, jewels are scattered everywhere.
Everywhere.
but they ignore the gold, and they venture deep into the back palace until they finally find the prize. They find the jade board.
The moment of triumph.
Yeah, and their reaction is so telling. They don't just celebrate. They start actively mocking the Dragon King.
Oh, yeah, they lay into him.
They look around at his wrecked palace and essentially say, you know, look at all this rich stuff he had, and he still wanted our jade board. His greed ruined his own country. He brought this disaster upon himself.
They're feeling pretty good about themselves.
Oh, they are sitting on their high horse, completely fueled by righteous indignation, and then the adrenaline crashes.
The physical toll of, well, boiling an entire ocean finally sets in.
They are exhausted, so they casually remind each other that they have the big Longwa assembly to attend the next morning.
Which is a huge deal.
Yeah, let me just give you a quick baseline for that. The Longwa Assembly is essentially the mythological equivalent of a mandatory, high-stakes, corporate all-hands meeting in heaven. You cannot be late to this.
No, attendance is absolutely required.
So rather than making the trek back to the surface, they declare, let's just spend the night right here in the captured palace, and they go to sleep.
Unbelievable.
If I try to put this into modern terms, imagine your favorite football team just won the Super Bowl in an absolute blowout. And instead of getting on the team bus to celebrate somewhere secure, they march directly into the opposing team's locker room, take back a stolen playbook, and then just throw down sleeping bags on the opposing team's floor. You are literally sleeping in the enemy's house.
What's fascinating here is the psychological trap they've fallen into.
Yeah.
It is a very specific, highly dangerous cognitive bias that triggers immediately after a massive victory.
Yeah.
When you achieve a goal that was fueled by intense, righteous, anger-like recovering a stolen symbol of your authority, your brain floods with a false sense of finality.
A false sense of finality. I like that.
Yeah. The immortals have localized the entire conflict into a single object. Their subconscious logic dictates that because they hold the jade board, the story is over.
The credits are rolling.
Exactly. The enemy is defeated. They are completely ignoring the geographical reality of the environment they're standing in.
Yeah.
They're like judging the Dragon King's moral failings rather than assessing their own immediate physical vulnerability.
It's the trap of the trophy. They're holding the item they came for, so their brains tell them, all right, we're done here.
They have utterly confused winning a battle with winning the war. Hubris basically masquerades as justice here. And that specific brand of hubris makes you incredibly blind to lingering threats.
Which brings us to the dead of night. Most of the immortals are completely passed out in this conquered, dried-up basin.
Unless asleep.
But the text makes a point to tell us that the elder immortal, Zhangguolao, is lying awake. He's one of the most ancient of the group, usually depicted riding a donkey backward, and he is a deeply observant sage.
He's the wise one.
Yeah, and he has things on his mind. He's got that lingering anxiety, that gut feeling that the math just doesn't add up.
Right.
And sure enough, around the fourth watch, which is, you know, between 2 and 4 a.m., the absolute darkest, quietest hour of the night, he feels the vibrations. Then he hears it, the distant, heavy booming of cannons.
Artillery in the dark. The enemy is mobilizing.
Zhangguolao immediately starts trying to rouse the other immortals. He's warning them about the loud voices outside and the impending counterattack.
And how do they react?
Oh, the younger immortals, the ones who were just celebrating so hard, are entirely dismissive. They actually say, they are defeated. How dare they return?
I love that line.
The audacity of that statement. They're genuinely offended that the enemy didn't read the script and realized they were supposed to give up and go away.
How dare they return? It's just a brilliant line that highlights how they view the conflict as a completely closed narrative. But, you know, warfare doesn't care about your narrative closure.
No, it really doesn't.
This is when another immortal, Iron Crutch Lai, steps up to defend the elder. Now, Lai is a gritty, pragmatic figure who walks with an iron crutch. He understands suffering, vulnerability, and warfare.
He's been around the block.
Exactly. And he starts quoting classical military strategy, directly echoing Sun Tzu. He notes that warfare is entirely about deception, that a good attacker strikes where the enemy is unprepared and appears where they're least expected.
Makes sense.
And then he points out the fatal flaw in their sleeping arrangements. They are currently sitting at the very bottom of the sea.
Okay, wait a minute. I have to jump in and push back on this scene, though.
Go for it.
Does having a magical nuke in your back pocket make you just ignore basic infantry tactics? We just established that earlier in the day, these beings used magic to literally boil the Eastern Sea.
Did.
So why is Iron Crutch Lai suddenly giving a mortal military briefing? Doesn't immense. ocean-boiling magical power render basic battlefield positioning completely irrelevant. I mean, if you can evaporate the sea, who cares if you sleep at the bottom of it?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, your pushback highlights the exact misconception the younger immortals hold. And it's a dynamic we see in modern power structures constantly.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The text is making a profound argument here. Raw power is completely useless without positional awareness. Magic, or, you know, in our world, endless capital, bleeding-edge technology, or market dominance, it doesn't negate the laws of strategy. In fact, it often amplifies the consequences of terrible strategy.
Because having that much power makes you arrogant enough to walk into traps you would otherwise easily avoid.
Precisely. If you don't have ocean-boiling magic, you never walk into an abyssal trench in the first place.
Mm.
Your power allowed you to bypass the natural defenses of the Dragon Kings, but it did not change the fundamental reality of the terrain.
Right.
The Dragon Kings are water deities. Their entire existence is tied to the ocean. The immortals willingly marched into a geographical bowl and took a nap.
Which is a terrible idea.
Right. They relied entirely on their active energy, their magic, to hold back an environment that the enemy controls passively. The moment the immortals went to sleep, their active control dropped. Magic doesn't save you if you choose to sleep on the train tracks.
And the theoretical threat becomes a terrifying immediate reality within seconds. Jean-Louis Kwan, the commander of the group, finally realizes the catastrophic mistake and sends Liu Dongbin, the swift swordsman, to scout outside.
But it's way too late.
It is way too late. Before the scout can even report back, cannons fire. The text says the sky shakes, and suddenly, mountain-like tidal waves rush in from all four sides simultaneously.
Just a total nightmare.
I want you to put yourself in their shoes for a second. You're standing in a deep basin, and massive rolling walls of black water are crashing down on you from every direction. The panic is absolute.
That's pure chaos.
They have no escape route. So they default to what worked yesterday. They try to use their signature fire magic to burn the sea again.
And this is where the environment dictates the outcome. The magic completely fails.
The text specifically notes that the immense water pressure coming down from above entirely extinguishes their flames. The fire has no light.
It's a brilliant detail.
It really is. They have the ultimate weapon, they try to use it, and the physical reality of the room just says, nope. The water rises up over their bodies. These are immortal beings, and they are literally drowning at the bottom of the ocean. There is no plan B.
Yesterday, their fire magic worked because they held the initiative. They attacked the sea from the outside using their energy to heat the surface.
Right.
Today, they're trapped at the bottom, trying to push fire upward against millions of tons of descending, crushing water pressure. The physics of the magic have flipped. The Dragon Kings have brilliantly used the immortals' own positioning against them.
But just when all hope is absolutely lost, they notice something bizarre. One of the immortals, Cao Guoju, often called the royal uncle because he's an aristocratic figure, isn't drowning.
He's perfectly fine.
He's completely fine. The water is magically parting around him wherever he walks. If he steps forward, the ocean splits. If he stands still, the water holds perfectly in place.
And it's not a spell.
No. The secret isn't some massive spell he's casting. It's his belt. His treasure belt is made of water-repelling rhinoceros horn.
To understand why this works, we have to look at the alchemy of this mythology.
Yeah.
In traditional Chinese lore, rhinoceros horn wasn't just a rare material. It was believed to have a deeply grounding, purifying essence. It was thought to detect poisons and, more importantly, create a metaphysical boundary that certain elements could not cross. It's a passive warding artifact.
So the immortals realize this passive ward is their only shot. They literally break his belt apart.
They snap it.
Yeah, they snap the precious artifact into pieces, hand one shard of the rhinoceros horn to each of the eight immortals, and using these tiny fragmented boundaries, they carve a narrow path through the crushing water to the shore and escape.
It's a stunning reversal of fortune, born from absolute desperation.
Here's where it gets really interesting. When you look at the mechanics of this rescue, it's like discovering that the beautiful, polished wooden hull of your sinking ship is actually made entirely of tightly packed life rafts.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. To survive, you have to systematically smash your own infrastructure, break it down into unglamorous pieces, and hand a chunk to everyone in the water just to stay buoyant. It is a wildly specific, mundane item that saves them, completely detached from their usual arsenal of apocalyptic magic.
That shift from the apocalyptic to the mundane is the core lesson regarding team composition. The eight immortals are an incredibly diverse group, pulling from different social classes, ages, and elemental affinities.
Very diverse.
And this scene highlights the absolute necessity of diversity in a team's toolkit. Their primary offensive weapon, their combined fire magic, the very thing that won them the battle yesterday, was rendered utterly useless by the environment.
Completely useless.
It wasn't their combined magical might, their raw power, or their aggressive tactics that saved them. They were saved by a passive defensive item carried by just one aristocratic individual on the team.
The heavy artillery was neutralized, so they had to rely on the guy with the weird belt.
If Cao Guju hadn't been wearing that specific accessory, like if they had all been uniformly equipped with the exact same fire-based weapons, they would have drowned in that basin. The text is illustrating that when your primary strategy is hard-countered by the environment, survival depends entirely on the hidden secondary utilities within your group. The utilities you probably weren't even thinking about when you planned the attack.
The Rhino Horn Belt is the ultimate contingency plan that wasn't even a plan. It was just a byproduct of their diversity. That is such a profound takeaway for any collaborative effort.
Absolutely.
You don't just need the heavy hitters. You need the specialized, seemingly passive tools, because you never know when a shift in the environment is going to turn your heavy hitters into liabilities.
And the speed with which they adapt. You know, breaking a priceless artifact apart to share its defensive capability shows that once their hubris is stripped away by sheer terror, they revert to being a highly functional collaborative unit.
They figure it out fast.
But the story doesn't end with them dragging themselves onto the beach, gasping for air.
No, it doesn't. And this is where the narrative pulls off an incredible cinematic camera move. The perspective completely flips. We leave the Immortals shivering on the shore, and the focus pans back under the water into the dark, flooded palace to show us the four sea dragon kings.
The architects of the ambush.
Yeah. They have successfully flooded their entire home. They have their aquatic troops mobilized, wading in the murky depths to capture the drowning Immortals and finally get their revenge.
And what do they see?
Well, as they look out into the flooded ruins of the basin, they don't see any movement. The water is perfectly still. There are no magical fireballs illuminating the deep. There's no struggle. So they come to a very logical yet entirely fatal conclusion.
They assume they won.
They assume they have successfully drowned their enemies. They believe the eight Immortals are dead corpses at the bottom of the sea.
You look at the silence and interpret it as definitive victory.
Aorun, one of the primary Dragon Kings, actually calls off the troops. He orders his entire army to stand down. The Dragon Kings meet up, and they start congratulating each other on a perfectly executed trap.
Oh.
And then, incredibly, the East Sea Dragon King orders his staff to prepare a lavish victory banquet right there in the exact same palace that was just the site of their humiliating defeat and now their supposed triumph. They literally sit down to drink, feast, and celebrate.
The structural irony of this chapter is brilliant.
So what does this all mean? We've got two sides of a massive mythical war, and they both seem to be making the exact same catastrophic choices.
This raises an important question about the cyclical, blinding nature of hubris. Think about the timeline we just walked through.
Okay.
Just hours ago, in that exact same physical location, the Immortals were celebrating a false victory. They thought the war was over because they acquired the Jade Board, so they let their guard down and went to sleep. Now, the waters have literally and metaphorically turned. The Dragon Kings have the immense tactical advantage. They have reclaimed their domain. And what do? They make the exact same mistake.
It's crazy.
They assume a lack of visible resistance means permanent victory. They dismiss their guards and throw a party to celebrate triumphing over enemies who, as we know, have secretly survived, escaped, and are currently on the shore, incredibly angry and ready to strike back.